To call this meeting of the Legacy Funding Division to order, our first official meeting of this session. And just briefly, before we get into our main topic today, which is the report of the legislative auditor, just give you, well, first, welcome all of you back, staff and visitors and everyone, and of course the members. And just very briefly, some of the plans for this session, for this committee. We will be dealing with the Lessard-Sams portion. They are on an annual funding, as you recall, and we will be doing that bill this year before very long, I would expect. There also will be probably a small amount for a supplemental budget regarding at least three of the funds. And I don't think we have more than $10 million in any account that we would use, and that's stretching it just a little bit. Maybe some policy issues, because we will be having hearings where we will listen to agencies, departments, citizens who wish to talk to us about basically how the system is working at this point, how is the reporting working, how is the accountability working, and if we need to, through policy, we can make some adjustments in a pretty thin policy bill that could be happening. We will then be listening to various reports, as we're doing today with the legislative auditor, and perhaps at some point we will visit some of the areas that we've been funding. I don't really like to use the term field trip, but as a former teacher, that comes to mind. Things that are close. We might go to the History Center, the Science Museum, and those types of things. Yeah, maybe Purbridge Center?
Mr. Chair, you're always welcome in Golden Valley.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. So, in any event, that's just a brief outline of the types of things that I expect us to be doing over the next couple of months.
Didn't get six yet, did you?
All right, we just have one item of business I'd like to do, and that's to approve those last session, last minutes, which, I mean, many of you have been hanging on here for the last many months. At this point, we are pleased to have with us today Mr. Jim Nobles, our legislative auditor, who will review for us the report that he issued a couple of months ago. Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me.
I see we did have a quorum. If you want, I would move the minutes.
All right. The minutes have been moved. Any objection? The minutes are passed. Now, we'll call for a vote. Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Get back in the swing of things here. Okay, Mr. Nobles, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the division. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And with me at the table is Cecile Perkle, who is the deputy legislative auditor for the financial audit division, and Judy Randall, who is an evaluation manager in the program evaluation division, and she was the manager of our legacy report. We actually are going to present you two reports because, as you know, the first responsibility that falls to us under the legacy amendment is to do financial audits. The legacy funds are just like every other fund and revenue source in the state of Minnesota. It falls under the jurisdiction of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So when that amendment passed, we took on a very big, important new responsibility and challenge. And so we intend to fulfill that, as I've indicated to this division before, by doing some financial audit work every year. We will probably be rotating among the various funds, and we may even take a somewhat different approach than we did this time. This time, we looked on a fund basis, and that works to some degree. It gives each fund a certain visibility. But what we find is that when we go into agencies, they have a mix of funds, particularly in this area. There may be game and fish fund. There may be money from the general fund or from the environmental trust fund. So we may take a somewhat different approach, but we will always give special attention and visibility to the issues related to how legacy money is being used. So that's our ongoing responsibility that we will have each and every year. And we are always open and eager to hear what concerns you have that might be addressed by a financial audit, which will basically be a control and compliance approach. But we thought that it was time, that we are far enough into the implementation of the legacy amendment, that we needed to also take a broad view. And so we proposed to the Legislative Audit Commission, and they approved, that we do an evaluation, which, as you know, takes a much broader look at a program or a fund or an activity or a department. And so that's what we would like to start with. And as I indicated, Judy Randall was the manager of that. She's going to make a presentation, which some of you have heard before. It won't change from the time you heard it. But I think it's helpful for us to go through this, if for no other reason, and I would also commend the report to you as simply a primer that will help not only you, but your colleagues and your constituents when they have questions about, well, how is the legacy amendment being implemented? There are four funds, as Judy's going to talk about in a minute. There are kind of four different approaches, and so it gets a little bit complicated. And so we'll be happy to run off just as many copies as you need for your colleagues, for your constituents, or others when they have questions about how the legacy amendment is being implemented and what issues there are that need to be addressed. So with no further preface from me, I'd like to ask Ms. Randall to make her presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm an evaluation manager with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk with you about our evaluation on the legacy amendment. Let me just start with a quick refresher. I'm sure this is all stuff you know, but just to make sure we're on the same page, a reminder of the legacy amendment. As you know, in 2008, Minnesota voters passed the constitutional amendment that raised the state sales tax by 3/8 of 1% and dedicated the money raised through that increased sales tax to specific purposes. The amendment is projected to raise between $240 and $300 million annually. And as you know, it was approved for 25 years. So it's right now scheduled to end on June 30th, 2034. If you do the somewhat simple math of the annual projected amount to be raised by 25 years, you quickly realize that the amendment is projected to raise between $6 and $7.5 billion over the course of 25 years. So we're talking a significant amount of money. In addition to raising the state sales tax, the legacy amendment established four funds: the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Clean Water Fund, the Parks and Trails Fund, and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and also allocated a percentage of the revenue raised through the state sales tax to each of the funds. So as you can see, and as you already know, the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund each receive a third of the money raised, and then the remaining third is split, although not evenly, between the Parks and Trails and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. The amendment also identifies specific purposes for which the money can be spent from each fund. So just going through each of the funds, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the purpose is to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. The Clean Water Fund focus is to protect, enhance, and restore surface water, groundwater, drinking water. Parks and Trails, the purpose is to support parks and trails of regional or statewide significance. And then the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund probably has the broadest set of purposes. It's for arts, arts education, arts access, and to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. So that's just a quick refresher on what the amendment accomplished. Now I want to walk quickly through how the legacy funds are appropriated. And this is a messy slide, and I've said this before when I give the presentation. It's recreated on page 43 of the report in front of you, and it may be easier to follow if you look at page 43 in the report, but I'll also put it up here slowly on the screen. So at the beginning, the money comes in through the sales tax, and in fiscal year 2011, about $250 million was generated. And it comes into the state treasury. And then the funding is allocated out to each of the funds as designated in the amendment. So again, one-third goes to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, one-third to the Clean Water Fund, and then the remaining third divided between the two remaining funds. Up to this point, the four funds are kind of treated the same. But this is where things start to get different. Two of the funds, the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund, have advisory councils. And two of the funds, the Parks and Trails Fund and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, do not have advisory councils. The two that do have advisory councils, those advisory councils are structured pretty differently and they do different things. So I'm going to walk through the differences here. So first, let's talk about the Lisard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. As you know, it's an advisory council established in a legislative branch. There are 12 voting members, four of whom are legislators. The Outdoor Heritage Council was created in anticipation of the legacy amendment being passed. It was created specifically to provide recommendations to the legislature on how the Outdoor Heritage Fund money should be appropriated. And as you know, they go through a comprehensive process where they take, they put out a request for projects, they do a competitive review process, they bring in organizations who are seeking the money and listen to their presentations. Members on the council individually score the projects and then ultimately put together a package of recommendations for appropriations that they must present to the legislature by January 15th of each year. The Clean Water Council is pretty different from the Lisard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. It's established in the executive branch. There are 19 voting members, none of whom are legislators. There are four legislators who are non-voting members who sit on the council, and there are five representatives of state agencies who are also non-voting members. The Clean Water Council predates the Legacy Amendment. It was established in 2006 as part of the Clean Water Legacy Act. And it wasn't until 2011 that the legislature gave it the specific responsibility for making appropriations recommendations related to the Clean Water Fund. And unlike the Lisard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, it doesn't go through a project-focused competitive review process. Instead, it sets more programmatic priorities and works with state agencies pretty closely to develop and recommend priorities on a broader programmatic basis. Now, as I mentioned, Parks and Trails Fund and Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund do not have the same type of permanent advisory councils established in law. Parks and Trails Fund, as you know, has historically been allocated on a formulaic basis, allocating the money to three distinct areas of interest: state parks, parks of regional significance in the metropolitan area, and then parks of regional significance outside of the metropolitan area. This past session, as you know, the legislature asked the commissioner to establish kind of an ad hoc advisory committee to talk about that funding allocation and what that formula should be. But it was a much more narrow-focused advisory group, and it doesn't have the permanence in law the way the other two advisory councils do. Now, the DNR Commission has also initiated an advisory council on his own, and that may have some of the broader interests more comparable to the Clean Water Council and Lisard-Sams Council, but it's not established in law, and there's kind of no guarantee that that's going to continue once this commissioner is no longer in his role. The Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund does not have an advisory council, and frankly, it may be difficult to have an advisory council for the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund that fully reflects the broad interests related to that fund. So instead, large pots of that money, as you know, are appropriated to the State Arts Board and the Historical Society. But then for other areas of allocation there, interest groups and organizations and agencies come directly to the legislature or work with individual legislators to have bills come through for appropriations. So whether there's the advisory councils or folks coming directly to the legislature takes in all this information. And ultimately, of course, the legislature is responsible for appropriating the legacy money, and it allocates it out to a number of different state agencies. Here I've just listed some of the major ones: DNR, PCA, Bowser, the Arts Board, Historical Society, et cetera. In 2011, there were 13 to 15 state agencies that received legacy money. And then the state agencies ultimately allocate the money out to the ultimate funding recipients. Oftentimes, it's the agencies themselves that are the ultimate recipients, so, you know, DNR is the ultimate recipient of significant amount of legacy money. But then they also may be allocated through a grants process to non-government organizations, or they pass it on to organizations that were named directly in law. So it's important to remember that even those organizations that were named in law by the legislature as recipients of the legacy money, that money must first flow through a state agency that serves as the fiscal agent. So when we looked at this mess. I mean, it's not a mess, but it looks messy on the screen. When we looked at this structure, we thought, wow, there's a lot of differences among the four fronts. I didn't mean to say that this is a mess. I just want to clarify for the record, because sometimes things get quoted. It just looks messy, that's all. It doesn't mean it is messy. So we see that there's some differences there among the fronts. First, whether or not there's an advisory group or not. Secondly, how the money is allocated. Again, the Lassard Sam's Council, you know, allocates the money after going through a competitive review process. Compare that to the Parks and Trails Fund money, which is allocated really on a formulaic basis. And then finally, the amount of oversight that's provided. Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council provides a significant amount of oversight through the year on how the money is spent. They look to see that expenditures out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund are complying with accomplishment plans that have been approved as part of the appropriations. In comparison, the Clean Water Council, for example, doesn't provide that type of ongoing oversight. Instead, it relies on the state agencies to provide that oversight of the Clean Water Fund expenditures. So when we looked at these differences, you know, we talked a lot in the office about these differences and whether it made sense that these differences existed and whether every fund should kind of be treated exactly the same and have the exact same process in place or whether it was okay that they were different. And ultimately we felt, well, the differences among the funds really reflect their history and their purposes and their constituencies, and kind of at the end of the day we accepted their differences and said, well, you know, these make sense. So for example, the Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council evolved because of a very active group of interest groups and stakeholders who were involved, you know, before the amendment was passed and had some very specific ideas about how the Outdoor Heritage Fund money should be used. The Clean Water Council, of course, predates the Legacy Amendment, and I think the legislature wisely said, hey, we have a council here that has water expertise, let's leverage that rather than create a whole additional advisory group related to water. Similarly, for the Parks and Trails organizations, there were already robust systems in place at DNR related to state parks and at the Met Council for parks of regional significance in the metropolitan area. And so again, I think the legislature said, well, let's tap into that expertise rather than creating, you know, a duplicative parallel system. And finally, relating to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, you know, the Arts Board and the Historical Society already in place, already have effective grants management processes in place, and they already have the reach across the whole state and mechanisms to distribute the money, you know, across the state as warranted. So the differences among these funds, you know, made sense, and I think it was an effort of the legislature to not just simply create advisory councils to create them, but instead to leverage what was already in place. So we accept the differences, but then we did find some what we called ongoing concerns that were relevant for all of the funds. So despite their differences in structure or process, these four ongoing concerns were things that all of the funds are going to have to grapple with, we think, over the remaining life of the amendment. And let me just put them up there quickly, and then I'll spend a little time talking about each one. So the first is whether or not we're achieving the desired outcomes with the legacy funds. You know, are the outcomes what the voters and the legislature intended when the legacy amendment was passed? Something that there's been a lot of discussion about and a lot of concern about. Another ongoing concern is whether or not the legislature and others are complying with the supplement, not substitute requirement, and I'll talk more about that. There's concerns about conflicts of interest related to legacy funds, and then there's also concerns about complying with the requirements related to administrative expenses. So I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on each one of these real quickly. First, related to the intended results. You know, there have been concerns raised about how the legacy money is being used and whether or not we're getting what we intended to. And for this one, the intended results, of course, are different for each fund. So there's maybe a different concern under this umbrella for each fund. So first, related to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, there's concern that the money is being used to purchase more state land. Before the legacy amendment was put in place, there were concerns about the amount of public land the state owned and the ability of the state to manage those resources. And, you know, with the use of Outdoor Heritage Fund money in part to purchase additional public land and state-owned land, I think those concerns have continued to be there. Related to the Clean Water Fund, there have been concerns about whether or not the money is being used to produce measurable outcomes. There's concern that maybe too much of the money is being used for testing and monitoring rather than cleaning up a lake or preventing additional pollution from happening. Related to the Parks and Trails Fund, there's concern that the money is being used simply to maintain existing parks and trails rather than to enhance the system or further improve the system or add additional recreational opportunities. And finally, related to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, there have been concerns raised about the money being spent to support projects of marginal significance and maybe not projects as grand or meaningful as people had originally intended. So this is the one ongoing concern where we don't have recommendations. We just kind of acknowledge that these concerns are out there and something that the legislature and stakeholders of the four funds are going to have to grapple with, I think, throughout the life of the amendment. The next ongoing concern is related to the supplement, not substitute provision. And, you know, the legacy amendments requirement that the money be used to supplement and not substitute for traditional sources has caused a lot of questions and uncertainty about what that exactly means. So just as a reminder, the amendment requires legacy funds to supplement and not substitute for traditional sources of funding. That's what the language in the Constitution says. But this language leads to a number of questions. The first one is, what constitutes a traditional source of funding? If an activity started last year and received general fund money, does that now mean general fund money is a traditional source of funding for that activity and legacy money couldn't be used in place of it? Does an activity need to be funded for 5 years or 10 years before it becomes a traditional source of funding? So there's a lot of questions when you get into the details of this language about what it actually means. There was a proposal that we kind of worked through in the report put forward by a number of environmental groups. Saying they sent a letter to the governor and legislative leaders last summer saying that to comply with the supplement, not substitute requirement, the legislature would need to allocate 1% of the general fund to the Great Outdoors, Minnesota Great Outdoors purposes, and that 1% was kind of a historical low number from the general fund that had been allocated in previous years. And we thought a lot about it and about that proposal, and we think that proposal makes a lot of sense from an advocacy position, but we don't think it's something that can be enforced. We don't think that that language is actually what's in the Constitution. The Constitution says that we need to not substitute for a traditional source of funding, but it does not talk about a level of funding, the traditional level of funding. Nor do we think that the language in the law kind of binds future legislatures of making decisions on where to spend money and their priority setting process. We think that's the prerogative and important responsibility of the legislature, and the language about the legacy amendment doesn't restrict that. So I'm sure we'll talk more about that. I'm sure there will be questions, but I'll move on to what our recommendations are related to this ongoing concern. So our first recommendation is for the legislature to establish a process to review the historical funding levels for projects that are proposed to be funded with legacy money. So if an organization comes forward and says, you know, we would like this activity to be funded with legacy money, we think the legislature should have a process kind of similar to the fiscal note process, where the committee chair or the author of the bill could say, you know what, I'd like to get some more information. I'd like to see what the historical funding was for this program. How have we funded it previously? And have that information to inform the process. It wouldn't be an enforcement mechanism. It wouldn't dictate what you could or couldn't do, but it would show kind of some serious consideration of looking at the historical funding and looking at the traditional sources of funding and then making a kind of more informed decision on how you want to fund that activity going forward. We also recommend more generally to state agencies and all recipients of legacy money, because this provision applies to all legacy fund recipients, that they need to document how they're complying with this provision. We acknowledge that the language is kind of vague, but just because it's not super clear doesn't mean that you can't comply with it. It doesn't mean that you don't give it due consideration. So we think it's important that everybody really show due diligence and show that they are giving serious consideration to this requirement. The next ongoing concern is related to conflicts of interest, and we think this is maybe the ongoing concern that's going to be the most persistent over the life of the legacy amendment. There's a bunch of things that complicate it. First of all, there's a lot of different opinions about what constitutes a conflict of interest, and complicating that is that there are different conflict of interest laws and policies depending on which organization we're talking about, which fund we're talking about, what the relationships are. So the Lessard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council has different conflict of interest laws and policies that apply than, say, a technical advisory panel for the Minnesota State Arts Board. So to determine if a conflict of interest exists requires a really deep understanding of the specific laws that apply, the specific policies apply, and the specific relationships that are in question. We spoke to the organizations that were involved in appropriating and allocating legacy money, and for the most part, we found that agencies and organizations were doing a good job kind of managing conflicts of interest, mitigating conflicts of interest, and having a culture that airs any concerns and solves them. The one exception was the Clean Water Council, which had not paid, when we did the evaluation, they had not paid close enough attention to conflict of interest concerns. So, not surprisingly, our first recommendation related to conflict of interest was that the Clean Water Council should develop some conflict of interest policies and procedures. I'll note that we gave this presentation to the Clean Water Council in December, and I know that they have already taken action and are developing conflict of interest policies that address our concerns. And I think they're working with the Office of Grants Management and maybe some other organizations to use state resources that are already available related to this issue. But then more generally, we recommend to really all state agencies involved in implementing the legacy amendment to be sure to continue to give conflict of interest concerns serious consideration. This is an important issue, and again, it's one that's not going to go away. So they need to keep being vigilant and keep this at the front of their radar screen. The last ongoing concern I just want to touch on is related to administrative expenses. And you know, agencies are unclear on how to comply with some of the requirements for administrative expenses. And as you know, the law right now requires administrative expenses to be, quote, directly related to and necessary for the legacy funded activity. And this was a change that the 2011 legislature put in for most of the funds. Prior to the 2011 change, for three of the funds, administrative expenses were often handled under a percentage cap procedure. So an allocation would be given to an agency, and you know, 1% or 3.5% or 5%, depending on the appropriation, was allowed for administrative expenses. In 2011, this language changed to now not have the percentage cap, but instead just be directly related to and necessary for. This gave agencies a lot more discretion. It also gave them a lot more responsibility for demonstrating this link. Some of the agencies we spoke with wanted to still be able to use their indirect cost allocation rate. So typically for some of these agencies, when they get an appropriation, they would, you know, kind of a standard basis, take maybe 1% and use that for their human resources or their IT staff, things like that. And they wanted to still be able to use that for legacy money, and that's not allowable now with this language. Some agencies complained to us about the burden posed by this language, that now they had more reporting to do or more accounting to do because they had to demonstrate this link that it was directly related to and necessary for. And, you know, while we were sympathetic to the agencies, because it may be a little more work, we also think that that's kind of the cost of receiving the money, that constitutionally dedicated funds come with strings attached, and that's the nature of the beast. So we had some recommendations related to administrative expenses. First, we think it's important that state agencies and legacy fund recipients document how they're complying with this requirement regarding administrative expenses. We think it's an important piece of the amendment and of receiving the funding.
Ms. Randall, okay. Do you think that and we'll be asking this directly to them, but do you think that they would rather just go back to a percentage cap?
Mr. Chair, members, you know, I wouldn't dare speak for them, but I think this gives them a lot more flexibility. And so if I were them, I think I would prefer this. I think there's some bumps to be worked out in terms of how to report it and, you know, what's enough reporting, you know, what's sufficient reporting. And I think when Ms. Frickel starts talking about the financial audit and they got into some of these issues in more depth, you know, she'd be able to provide some insight. I think that this is going to be workable. I think that it's an adjustment, and that once folks work out a system for adequately accounting for their administrative expenses, I think it'll be beneficial in the long run.
Thank you. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our last recommendation here related to administrative expenses is to the Department of Management and Budget, and we recommend that they play a leadership role here with agencies and help them to think through how to report and account for their administrative expenses. The 2011 legislature required MMB to provide some guidance related to accounting codes related to the legacy amendment. So this recommendation just kind of builds on that and asks them to provide some leadership to agencies to think through how they're going to handle this. So, Mr. Chair, in response to your question, I think that, you know, if MMB provides some leadership and agencies start to network and learn best practices from each other, I think that they'll be able to handle these reporting requirements without too much difficulty. The financial audit went into the administrative expense issue a lot more, in a lot more depth. So at this point, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Ferkel, who can talk more about that audit.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Ms. Ferkel, welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor. And I'd like to discuss with you the results of our financial statement audit, really our first more in-depth look at the legacy funds and how those funds are being used. In this audit, we examined the Outdoor Heritage, Clean Water, and Parks and Trails. We did not look at the Arts and Cultural Heritage. We're currently, right now, planning our upcoming audits of the Arts and Cultural Heritage expenditures. So we'll be looking at that shortly and providing a report in the future on that. So the scope of our audit was from July 2009 through January 2011. July 2009 is when the appropriations first became available for expenditure. We looked primarily at three state agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And we also followed the money through to 10 grantees that received some of that money. So I'd like to take a few minutes to explain to you how we determined that scope. When we looked at the expenditures that had occurred during that time period, July 2009 through January 2011, we found that there had been about $142 million of legacy funds spent. And when we looked at where those expenditures occurred, we saw that about 60% of the money had been spent by DNR, about 14% by Pollution Control, and about another 14% by Bowser, approaching then 90% of the money being spent in those three agencies, with just a little over 10% being spent by five other state agencies in the U of M, and a small amount being spent by the legislature as part of the establishment of the legacy website and the operations of the LSART SAMS Council. So we thought that focusing on those three agencies really gave us a big presence in auditing the funds. When we look at those agencies and how they spent the money, we found that they really administered the funds differently. Their uses of the funds were pretty different from each other. If we look at DNR, we see that about 52% of their money was used for purchases of lands or purchases of easements. And that's a little skewed because a big part of that was the purchase related to the Blandin Paper Company, which was an individually large transaction, but that is where most of their money went. About 25% of their money was used to make grants to other entities, and about 8% of it was used for internal operations, payroll-related kinds of things. Now, if you look at Pollution Control, they didn't have any land or easement-type purchases. About 7% of their money was used for grants, but really 40% of their money was used for payroll and another 53% for other non-payroll-related departmental operations. So that really reflects that PCA was using the legacy money more for internal operations or their own projects that they were administering themselves. And then when we look at the Board of Water and Soil Resources, we see that they had some land and easement purchases, but really the bulk of their expenditures were grants made to other entities. 77% of their expenditures were for grants. And they had smaller amounts, 7% and a little bit more for their internal operations and payroll. So we really had a mix of different types of transactions that we were looking at. We did follow the money through to other grantees that received the funds through those. Because the Outdoor Heritage money was the fund that provided most of the grants, most of what we looked at was Outdoor Heritage. We also did look at the largest grant made through the Clean Water Fund and through the Parks and Trails funds. So we did go out to these entities and took a look at their ability to account for their use of these funds and how well they were able to segregate these funds from other money that they had to administer. And most of the grantees were nonprofit entities. We did have Anoka County and the City of Nisswa were also in this group. But Although we did have a few isolated instances of things that we questioned, really for the most part we were pretty impressed with the ability of these organizations to do a good job of being accountable for how these funds are being used. So the objectives of our audit were to look at the internal controls and the ability of the entities, whether the state agencies or the subgrantees, to account for these funds and to show their compliance with the legal requirements. We generally found that they did comply, and we, for the most part, felt that they had done a good job in assuring good accountability. So really it was a good conclusion, but the report does include six findings areas. And I'd like to just discuss a few of these areas and some of the issues that are presented in the report. First of all, the agencies didn't have adequate documentation or justification to show how some costs that they used the funds for complied with the purposes of specific appropriations of the legacy money. And first I'd like to talk about payroll, and then there's some other kinds of costs too. So some of the agencies were not able to show us how payroll costs that they estimated corresponded to the actual work provided by employees of their department. So what some agencies do is, especially maybe if they have multiple funding sources, is they'll identify an employee and say, well, 40% of this employee's salary is going to be paid with legacy money and 60% is going to be paid with some other source like game and fish money or general fund money or maybe even federal money or something like that. So they would set up these estimates at the beginning of the employee's assignment. But they didn't have a way to circle back around and say, did that estimate correspond to the work that employee actually did? So without some kind of periodic verification that estimate corresponded to the actual amount, there was an increased risk that legacy money might be used to pay for services that didn't contribute to the projects and activities of specific appropriations. Agencies also didn't have adequate documentation to justify how some other payroll costs that were allocated complied with the purposes of the appropriation. For example, the agencies didn't have support for inconsistencies between how actual hours worked were charged compared to time off was charged. Specifically, as an example, one DNR employee had charged about 43% of his working hours to an appropriation from the Clean Water Fund, but 100% of his vacation time was charged to the Clean Water Fund. So if the employee had allocated his time and his vacation time in proportion to his work hours, about $3,400 worth of vacation hours would have been paid from some other funding source. There were similar kinds of inconsistencies related to employee separation payments and to unemployment payments that agencies made, where we didn't see a good connection between how those costs were charged related to how the employees' work hours were allocated. The agencies also allocated some other costs, non-payroll types of costs, without sufficiently documenting or justifying how those costs complied with the purposes of the legacy appropriation. For example, through January of 2011, pollution control allocated about $6.6 million of costs to legacy appropriations using their allocation rates designed to recover costs related to their general operations, such as human resources, accounting, information technology. But the department wasn't able to show us how those allocations related to the cost of actually administering the grant programs or running the expectations that the appropriations were for. For example, the agency used the cost allocation rate to charge a $4.5 million grant program, about $890,000, without being able to show us how that administration of that grant program was going to actually cost the agency $890,000. So neither the state nor the agencies had policies that addressed these types of allocations to ensure that the costs that were allocated complied to the purposes of the appropriation. So our recommendation is that the agencies work with MMB to establish consistent policies to ensure compliance. Another area that we had a finding on related to advances that were made to grantees. Generally, reimbursements to grantees of costs they've actually incurred is a preferred method of providing grant funds, but it's not a required method. Reimbursement allows the agency to review whether or not the costs were appropriate to the grant before they actually pay those costs to the grantee. The Lasard Sams Council does require that its grants from the Outdoor Heritage Fund be on a reimbursement basis unless the advance of funds was specifically approved by the council. We did find that the Board of Water and Soil Resources advanced about $136,000 to grantees without this specific authorization from the Lazard-Sams Council. Pollution control grants from the Clean Water Fund don't have that kind of requirement, but the agreements that the Pollution Control Agency entered into with its grantees did require that payment would be based on the grantees' invoices of actual costs incurred. But PCA did advance a grantee $450,000 that the grantee, at the time that we did the audit, still had over $300,000 of that money invested in a money market account rather than having been used. So we're recommending that the agencies not advance grant funds unless they're authorized either by the Lazard-Sams Council or by the grant agreements that they enter into with the grantees. So the final area I want to talk about is oversight of grantees. We did have a couple of instances where we felt that the agencies could do a better job in providing oversight. We saw that all three of the agencies paid some grantees for costs without sufficient documentation to ensure that the costs complied with the purposes of the specific appropriations. For example, DNR reimbursed a grantee for costs that were incurred before they were allowable by the grant agreement. And in another case, Pollution Control reimbursed a grantee about $111,000 for costs that the grantee did not provide the department with adequate support. We recommended that the agencies ensure that they only reimburse grantees for costs that are adequately supported so that the agency can ensure that they comply with the grant agreements. We also had two issues related to match requirements. The first one involved Bowser, and it was really a broad issue in Bowser's grant agreements. They didn't specify what the match requirements were, although they incorporated a work plan that stated what the match amount was. The grant agreement itself didn't say what the requirements were. Now, matches can have a variety of different kinds of requirements. Maybe the match is required to be cash, or it can be in kind, or it can be other kinds of donated goods, that kind of thing. So those requirements often are set in statute, and we felt that it was important for those requirements to be in the grant agreement so that it was clear what the requirements were. We were concerned that without it being in the grant agreement, either the grantee may inadvertently not comply with it or that board staff may not adequately ensure that the requirement has been met. Pollution Control also had an issue related to match, and it was more specific grants. One grant had a date set in the appropriation law by when the match needed to be designated by the grantee, and although our testing showed that the grantee seemed to have met the match requirements by that date, we didn't see any evidence that Pollution Control had monitored that grantee to ensure that the match was actually met by the date. If the match had not been met, the appropriated funds would not have been available to the grantee. So we felt that was an important requirement that Pollution Control should have done a better job of overseeing that grant requirement. We recommended that PCA verify and document that the grantee had satisfied the match requirement by the deadline. We also found that Pollution Control allowed a grantee to use some costs as match without sufficient evidence that those costs provided benefit to the program. And we recommended, again, that PCA do a better job of reviewing the types of costs or donated services that are being provided as match for the grant to meet the match requirement, that they are providing benefit for that project or program. I talked really fast, didn't I? So I'm sorry about that. I hope you were able to track along with me. That's the conclusion of our presentation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Purple. Members, do you have questions? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Nobles and others, if I've missed this in the presentation, let me know. But when you talk about supplant, the big word, how much time has to elapse between the last time it was funded and the current funding that comes from the legacy before they don't consider it funding something that should be funding? In other words, if the DNR funded a program years ago but then quit, and then the legacy takes that up, what in your mind constitutes a long enough period of time between funding where it wouldn't be considered supplanting and something that they should have done? Or is it the terminology or the time, or what would best define that?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nobles,
Representative Cornish, I think you raise one of many examples of why it's very difficult, it certainly was for us, to come to a definitive conclusion on what the supplement, not supplant requirement requires. because there are the kinds of ambiguities and questions that you just raised, and we talk about that in the report, I think there was some expectation and hope that maybe the auditors, in doing both the financial audit work and our program evaluation work, that we would answer those questions, that we would come up with our own checklist to try and fill in some of the details and clear up some of the ambiguity that exists in the constitutional provision. We decided not to do that. I don't think that is our role, frankly, to make up standards that don't exist in some authoritative place, be it in the Constitution or the statute. Just to address your point more generally, I mean, what we recommend is that there be a mechanism within the legislature, kind of a formalized mechanism, kind of like a fiscal note process, where you would get that exact kind of information laid out for you in an accurate, objective way, so you as the legislature could come to the conclusion among yourselves as to whether or not you're complying with the legacy amendment, supplement, not supplant. We think, even though it is a constitutional provision, which means that at some point, yes, somebody could sue the state, sue you as the legislature, and get the court to impose some standard on you. That could happen. But we think that in the meantime, the language leaves you with a good deal of flexibility and discretion to decide, as you decide a lot of matters of priority and funding, whether or not you want to put legacy money into a program that has lapsed or been funded from some other source in the past. So, again, we didn't come to a checklist that we can provide you that answers that specific question about how long a period of time has to lapse before it's no longer considered a traditional source of funding. Not sure if I completely answered your question. I'm sure others might have additional questions on this, because it really has been kind of the central area of concern and controversy. And we, too, think it is a very perplexing issue. That's why we identified it in this report as what will be, what we think, is an ongoing issue and concern. But we don't have a simple, easy answer for it.
The thank you. The
Representative Cornish.
Problem we got, Mr. Chair, is that you mentioned fiscal notes or something like a fiscal note. Our fiscal notes have been, unfortunately, it seems like turning political or a way to kill a bill lately. If you want to make sure a bill doesn't survive, you heap a big fiscal cost on it. And so we're suspect of the ability to turn out good fiscal notes lately. I don't know if you folks looked at that. Was there a study that was just done on the fiscal note process?
Mr. Chairman, members, we're issuing a report tomorrow on fiscal notes. But let me just clarify that we compare this a bit to fiscal notes, but this would be quite different. Because
Mr. Nobles, are you suggesting that would we need statute to do this? Or
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe you would have to have a statute. But possibly establish and rule or even just informally establish a process, however you want to do it. But the real difference here, to Representative Cornish's concern, is that a fiscal note is trying to project what costs will be in the future. That's why they, almost by their very nature, can be sometimes not very reliable and can cause some concern and even suspicion on the part of people that those projections have some bias in them or just aren't reliable. And we're going to address that tomorrow. Here, what we're talking about is not projecting what costs would be in the future, but what has happened in the past. So in this case, we have a history. And so somebody could go into the state's accounting records and say, here's a particular program. What has been the revenue source? Has it received game and fish money? Has it received bond money? Has it received general fund money? And so it's a historical record that we think should be available to you, not an estimate or projection about what expenditures or costs will be in the future. So I think it will be, should be certainly, much more reliable.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. You missed the point, by the way. You were supposed to solve all of our problems with this.
I realize that, Mr. Chairman, and that's why I have encountered a good deal of disappointment and frustration with how we ended up. But You know, and frankly, it's a bit frustrating and disappointing to us, because as I started, I mentioned the fact that we have an ongoing financial audit responsibility where we do, as Ms. Burkle just said, compliance and control work. Compliance means, are we complying with the law and the constitutional provision? And obviously one of the important constitutional provisions is supplement, not substitute. And so when the amendment passed, we thought that as the auditors of these funds, we would have a responsibility to answer whether or not the state was complying with that provision. And as I have been told on various occasions, the job of an auditor is a bit like an umpire in a baseball game. You call balls and strikes. And that's what we like to do. We like to be very definite and certain. Is something in compliance or not? But every once in a while, we confront an issue of compliance where the strike zone isn't really very well established. And I know you don't see this in baseball games, but sometimes we, as the umpire of this game, have to say, after the ball is thrown, we're not sure. Now, I hope it doesn't enter into baseball games. That would kind of frustrate all of us. But I think it's the responsible thing for us to do as auditors of state government, as an agent of the legislature. Where there is ambiguity, I don't think you want us going out on our own, under our responsibility and authority, making up a standard that hasn't been well established in law. We really want to use the law, the Constitution, statutes as our reference point. And there have been other occasions when we come back to you where we've gone out to try and call a ball or a strike, and we've come back and said we can't do that because the law is not clear. In this case, we don't think the constitutional provision is clear. I don't quite know what we do going forward, other than what we suggest, as Ms. Randall was saying, is that this be taken seriously. We're not saying that just because it's not clear it can be disregarded. But again, we think that there is a zone of discretion that the legislature has for deciding where to put legacy money. And there are various interpretations of what compliance would be. And you know, one of those would be that you have to continue to fund out of the general fund for the great outdoors. Ms. Randall mentioned this. You have to have a 1% funding level from the general fund. That is something that you could adopt as a matter of policy. Our only point is we don't find that as a legally binding requirement in the legacy amendment. But it doesn't mean going forward that you as a legislature couldn't say, as a matter of policy, as a matter of setting priorities for the state of Minnesota, that's a good idea and that's what we're going to do. But we just didn't find that as a legally binding requirement on you in the constitutional amendment itself. So, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot that could be said on this particular issue, and I don't want to take up more time than you need on it, but so I'll stop there and see if there are other questions.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles and Ms. Randall, Ms. Ferkel, thank you very much for your work. We're in the fourth year of the Legacy Amendment and the Legacy Committee. And I think that your work between the third and fourth year will be very, very helpful for the 21 years remaining. I was not shocked or surprised about any of your conclusions or your outcomes, because it seems to me that from the beginning we had several groups of interested parties that knew exactly why people voted yes. But I think there were almost as many different reasons for voting yes as there were people that voted yes. And in addition to that, then, there was the 44% left that voted no, but said, okay, let's change things around Minnesota with this amendment. So, the time that we spent the first 2 years, Mr. Chair, we never came to a conclusion for sure why all the people voted yes or no, or what their expectations were. But we did try to combine them, but it only seemed like the House committee was working, and everybody else was working more toward how the money was going to be spent and how quick could we do it and what could we get off the ground right now. And as a result of that, we didn't have a strong framework in place before we started. And so we're going to have to make some changes along the way, it seems to me. And we need something stronger than the legislative guide that the House of Representatives passed. That has principles and outcomes for all four funds in it. But I bet you didn't see this on anybody's desk of the people that you were evaluating or talking with. Or it wasn't something that someone was accepting as the pattern to follow when you were evaluating their spending or how it rated. Because you know what? It would take some changes within the agencies. It would take some changes within the structures. And it would take a belief that this was different than the outcomes of LCMR or the outcomes of the grant program from the various agencies that were already giving out monies. I think that you have revealed to us that we need to strengthen our framework. I think that you've revealed to us that many good things are going on, and certainly as representatives that are out in our districts, we know that Minnesota is a different place because of the four funds and the legacy grants that have been given. And the legacy grants that are being anticipated. And there's still, I still hear, Mr. Chair, I hear people saying, we're still working on our ideas so that we can submit them for a grant application. So hope is still out there. And changes are still, or people are thinking about what's worthy enough for this money, rather than how much more will we get next year to do what we've been doing right along. But those still are two big competing interests. And I think, Mr. Chair, we should figure out how we can strengthen the framework and what we have, what's obtainable for the year to provide more guidance. But I don't know if you've been talking to the other body at all, but and knowing if they're willing or not to to work on that, or if we're just going to go forth. And I just strongly urge everybody to go through this report again now that we've heard it, and to evaluate the recommendations and think about how we can work together to get better outcomes and how we can help the applicants and the agencies with their concrete outcomes, expected outcomes and goals, so that the next 21 years will be a better job.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just...
Let me comment first. Sure. Thank you. Representative Murphy, it sounded like you were looking at a homework assignment there for yourself.
Partly, Mr. Chair, I'm not ready to give up.
No, certainly not. And regarding your suggestion or question about the Senate, I'm kind of guessing that they would leave this in our lap to work on.
Again.
Yes. And so I'm... You know, one of the things that we will be doing, as I indicated earlier, we will be talking to the departments and the agencies and the recipients about what works and what doesn't work and what we need to do to further develop a framework. I mean, that's, you know, part of what, if whatever we put together in policy, I hope we'll be doing that.
Mr. Noble. Chairman, I just wanted to say that as we did this evaluation, that the record that has been established over several years from the work of this division under the chair of Representative Murphy and then under the chair of Representative Erdahl was really a rich, rich source to us. So I do have to really compliment the very thoughtful approach that's been taken from the first day. And I went back and reviewed every meeting, listened to the tapes, and it was very valuable to us. The document that you reference is on my desk, if not elsewhere. And we really delved deeply into the history of its development and its demise, if we could say that.
Mr. Nobles, you listened to tapes of every meeting?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Including the one that went from 4 in the afternoon to 2 in the morning?
On the House floor?
No, the one in the committee.
I listened to a lot. In fact, I even had them put on a disc that I could put in my car radio.
Do you think we could sell that?
There's possible material there. I found it fascinating. But one of the things that was very helpful as part of that, to just cite a specific example, two maybe, you have spent a great deal of time under the chair of both representatives on some of the issues we talked about, both administrative expense and all of what we talked about from the shift from percentage to the broader standard came out of this division. We know that. We've talked about that a lot. But frankly, your consideration of the very perplexing supplement, not substitute, provision also was given very thoughtful consideration. The memorandum that you received from Mark Shepard was really the seminal document for me to make sure that I was well grounded in a legal analysis of that issue. And so we have really looked to the work of this committee for its historical record, but also its ongoing deliberations of these issues. That's why we particularly appreciate you dedicating a full meeting today to consider our reports. And so, again, I just have to take this occasion to express my appreciation.
Thank you. Representative Perkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the auditors for being here today. Some of your discussion and much of the criticism about the supplement and supplan issue really focuses on the general fund. As we all know, there's significant amounts of state spending that are outside of the general fund. Do you believe it's appropriate to consider those other sources of spending or funding when we try to wrestle with this issue of supplement and supplant?
Mr. Nobles.
Representative Perkelson, yes. I mean, I think the language itself does not distinguish It simply says a traditional source. So that could be game and fish money, bond money, general fund money, federal money. And I just want to add here a point that I think is worth considering and why I think we have not taken what some would have preferred, I know, a much more definite, if not actually rigid, interpretation of what the constitutional language requires. And I won't try to repeat all of the arguments that we used in the report. But one of the things that I think you really need to keep in mind, that whatever the standard is established will apply to everybody, to the legislature, to the executive branch, and to the nonprofits. And even though there are many nonprofit organizations out there, and they were the authors of the proposal to you that that you should, to comply with the supplement, not substitute, maintain a 1% general fund funding of the Great Outdoors programs. But they have to remember that if it becomes established as a standard, that if you have some historical funding for a particular activity and program, and it goes away, and then legacy money is available to fill that gap, that it would be a violation of the constitutional provision. If they want that to apply to them, they will also have some difficulty, as they told us, because some of the nonprofits said, you know, over the years, we used to get a grant from McKnight or some, the Bush Foundation, or somebody would give us $100,000, $200,000 to work in the area of habitat restoration and easement. But they changed their focus, and we don't get that money anymore. We got it for 10 years, or however long we got it. So, yeah, you could say that was our traditional source of funding for that activity, but it's gone. But here's legacy money that could allow us to continue that work. So we face the choice. Do we just drop out of doing that work, or do we go for legacy money? But if we go for legacy money, we do have to consider, as we say, whether or not, in the discretion of the legislature, you want to say, yes, the better alternative there is to use our discretion, not apply an overly rigid interpretation of the supplement, not substitute provision, and say the better public interest is to use legacy money to have that nonprofit continue that work. So I think, again, it is just worth considering that if we get to, for example, a court decision, you didn't get a, I don't think you got a rigid interpretation, a strict interpretation, a checklist of do's and don'ts from the legislative auditor. But if you were to get that from a court, it would apply to everybody. And I just think everybody needs to keep that in mind.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that, thank you for that perspective, Mr. Nobles, because I think it's an appropriate one. Because after all, if some program would be defunded and the legacy money, the easiest thing to do would be for legacy to then just not fund it, because then we do not run the risk of doing any supplanting if we don't supply any funds to a particular program that would be cut from the legislature or from any other source of funding. So they would then receive a double whammy. My approach to this is we consider these programs and their value and whether or not they should appropriately be funded, and you can't really base your decision on what's happened with other sources of funding. I realize the language of the Constitution kind of demands that we do, but yet it's really a conundrum.
Well, and I would just add another point, which is in the report, but it just bears a repeating. You know, we went through various analysis, as Mr. Shepard did, in coming to his conclusions in his memorandum. And that would be, what is the language, just looking at the plain language of the constitutional provision, what does it tell us? And then we got the points of ambiguity there. And when you do that, you often then, as you know, go to legislative history. And what does legislative history tell you? And the interesting thing is, it was a chief proponent of the legacy amendment, the chief author in the Senate, when asked, does this language bind the legislature to maintain a historical level of funding for these programs from the general fund, the Game and Fish Fund, Bond Fund. Does this language bind the legislature? The chief proponent in the debate said no, it does not. It was actually the opponents of the legacy amendment, out of concern, who suggested that the language was going to put the legislature in a box, in a bind, and therefore advocated against the amendment. But I just think, again, we need to remember that when the amendment was before the legislature, it was the advocates of the amendment that said, no, the language does not bind the legislature.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Noble, thank you for being here. I have a question. It's along the supplanting lines, too. Clearly, the legislature in the past year had a really tough task in front of it with the budget and the tough priorities, and certainly the legislature made choices, and they were difficult ones, and it would seem that when you put different things in front of the legislature, be they K-12 funding or grandma in the nursing home or state parks, they come to different priority levels in your thought process. And I think that the legislature was right to value those things differently. But assuming we have a different scenario in the future and we aren't at the tough situation of a serious budget deficit, but maybe a more robust situation, wouldn't that be different parameters where we would expect to see the legislature react differently, or you're really going to add fuel to this supplanting fire if the legislature didn't show discretion in good times as they should have discretion in tough times also?
Sure. Mr. Noble. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I've emphasized the point of the legislature's discretion during the time of budget cuts. But I agree that they would have some level of discretion in the good times too, but I just want to make sure I'm clear that I don't think the legislature's discretion with constitutional language is unlimited. I mean, I think that the language on its face says that you could not eliminate a source of funding. For example, I think to me what that language says, if traditionally you had funded something out of game and fish, out of fish licenses, you could not use legacy money if you totally eliminated the source. Our argument is the language doesn't say you have to maintain a certain level of funding. So again, there is a line somewhere out there that we would suggest you don't want to cross. It would invite a case. But within quite a range of discretion, both in good times and bad, I think what our recommendation is that you give the language due consideration through some of the mechanisms that we've recommended, that you demonstrate, as I think the legislature has a good deal in the committee hearings that I've been a part of, that you've been shown awareness of the concern and the issue and some of the difficult choices that you made. Whether or not in good times you would be expected to bring back all of the funding that was cut up to some level, the 1% that was suggested or the 2% or whatever that level is, either on an aggregate basis or on an individual programmatic basis, I think, again, is a policy choice. I don't think that's written into the Constitution that you have to do that. But I think it's within certainly your prerogative as stewards of the Treasury to say, in our allocation of money and our stewards of the Treasury to say, in our allocation of money and our setting of priorities, yeah, funding these programs has been, will continue to be, a matter of significant priority. Again, I think it's within your discretion to decide that.
Other questions? I'd just like to thank you for your presentation and echoing Representative Murphy a little bit. The things that you highlighted were certainly no surprises. I mean, we struggled all session with conflict of interest and administrative cost and supplement versus supplant. These are the three major issues that I'm sure we will continue to struggle with and try to find a resolution if there actually is such a thing. But we'll be continuing to be in touch with you, offering or asking for your help and advice on these prickly issues, and hopefully we will get something figured out eventually that does work. Hopefully it's working now. But as I indicated earlier, at some point and not too long from now, we will be asking the recipients, the agencies, the departments to come in and talk to us. I would like them to be on notice that we'll be asking what are your reactions to the report of the auditor, and particularly the specific things that might have been referenced to your department or agency, and also, again, reaction to the report, but suggestions that you might have for what's going to be improvements in the future. Anything else? Thank you very much. We will meet at our regular time next week. There was a signal. It was on high. And we'll be meeting at our regular time, and we will be considering the Lessard-Sams supplemental bill. This case is closed.